Hello, this is John Cleese, and you're listening to the Podcast Network.
There's got to be a better way to light up the world today. Something that we need, something safe and clean. Well, if you're searching, you can find the answer right before your eyes. It's atomic. It's atomic. There's no need to fear. We gotta let the whole world hear. It's atomic. It's atomic. It's atomic. And now, here's Rod Adams and the Atomic Show. It's atomic. Yeah. It's atomic.
Hi, this is Rod Adams, and it's time for Atomic Show number 88. And once again, I find myself in the position of having to apologize to you all for my sound recording foobars. I recorded a great interview with three guests, and I forgot to include the input from my own headphones. So the guest's recording came out great, and I'm going to have to reconfigure or regurgitate what I think I said during the course of the interview. So if it sounds a little strange, that's my fault. Anyway, tonight we're going to talk about what is known as the LNT controversy, linear no threshold dose assumption, and that is a radiation protection assumption hypothesis that has been in place for the last 40 to 50 years, and the assumption is that all radiation, no matter how small, is potentially dangerous and should be controlled. That assumption is considered by many to be a conservative assumption that causes no harm. But what the reality is a little bit different. And there's been a number of people who have been trying to press for the radiation protection standards and the regulations to be based on the scientifically determined dose response curves, which indicate that at very low doses there may even be a positive health impact rather than a negative one. Tonight I have with me Ted Rockwell, Michael Stewart, and Robert Margolis, and each one of them will introduce themselves and give you some background, and then we'll talk about this controversy. And as Ted Rockwell will point out to you, it's a controversy about regulations and radiation protection standards, not really about science.
Well, hi, that's I'm Ted Rockwell, and I'm an officer of international nonprofit outfit called Radiation Science Itself. And that was founded by Jim Muckerhide, who has collected a tremendous collection, several thousand reports, legitimate reports, several hundred of which are highly quotable and demonstrate what we're talking about today.
Now, next for Robert Margolis, but in the meantime, I want to highly recommend the website for Radiation Science and Health. It's a great resource to go back to after you've listened to this podcast.
This is Robert Margolis. I'm currently a reactor engineer in Florida. I have over 21 years of nuclear experience, including startup experience overseas, as well as safety analysis. And looking forward to tonight's discussion.
And Michael?
This is Michael Stewart. I currently work for Dominion Resources. I started off my career as a health physics technician and trying to implement some of those ALAR practices, spending lots of money to protect people from those low doses of radiation. Currently, I'm an instructor for Dominion, and I've been doing that for the last 8 years. And I'm really excited to be here because I've been looking forward to meeting Dr. Rockwell.
Michael mentioned the term ALARA, which means as low as reasonably achievable. And that is a imposed regulation that says that all people handling radioactive material under license by the NRC shall work to reduce doses to as low as reasonably achievable, and the reasonable test has been subject to many different interpretations over the years. And now Ted's going to explain why this issue is so important and why it has so many cost implications and health implications for the general population.
Okay, let me clarify two points out of that. You say 50 years. Jim Muckerhide has a couple of articles, that he, technical articles, published by legitimate scientists. The first one about 3 months after Rentgen had discovered X-rays back in 1895, in which he showed that using X-rays could cure low-dose infection. And he makes clear in that article way back then, and other better, more complete articles in 1911 and 1915, saying that it's clear that the radiation is not strong enough to kill the bacteria, that what is happening is apparently the radiation is stimulating the defense systems so that they respond and do the job. So hormesis has been understood all the way back that far. The other point to clarify is that we talk about the controversy and the debate. There really is no scientific debate on this thing. Nobody, I can't get anybody to stand up and make a scientific defense of the idea that low-dose radiation is harmful. What they will tell, if you look through these reports, and that's what is in that testimony I showed you, Rod, is not only do these reports say bluntly that there is no evidence that low-dose radiation is harmful, but since there's no harm in pretending that it is, it would be prudent to do that. And that is the great LNT theory. You know, you don't overturn a basic theory in the field. There's no theory there. It's a premise that says that since there isn't any good low-dose data, we'll assume that it is linear all the way down. And the only reason that they conclude that there is no data is because they've very carefully kept out these hundreds of good reports showing that there is plenty of good data.
I was first exposed to this controversy attending some ANS meetings back in the mid-90s when Jim Muckerhide was running a series of technical sessions. And it always appeared to me that the people who were interested in protecting the low dose rate assumption took the position of see no evil, hear no evil, speak no evil, so they would never even listen when you had good data to show them.
And also one thing to take note, I can speak for, you know, during my education it was always taught as a hypothesis. Even nowadays, even the major scientific bodies, ICRP and the others, I'm sorry, that's the International Commission for Radiological Protection. They were started, if I remember right, in 1928, long before there was any nuclear power. But they've always used the word hypothesis. I think even the National Academy of Sciences. So, one thing, it has never even made it to a theory. It has always been a hypothesis and an assumption to be used for regulators, which now, as we've been talking here, it's certainly taken on a life of its own.
Well, of course, the other point that's really critical here is I've talked to people about this thing, and the question always comes up, and it's a perfectly reasonable question. What's wrong with being a little pessimistic about this thing? I mean, maybe you're right, but what harm could it possibly do? And we've got some spectacular stories on that. Some of the most interesting ones are outside of the nuclear power field. For instance, there is a guy in California who over a period of 20, 25 years built up a beautiful big museum on historical aircraft. And he's got all these early aircraft and warcrafts and so forth that he's been doing in there. And some of them, of course, have radium instruments. And the EPA got in there, and on the basis that there is no amount of radiation that is safe, they condemned the building. they ended up not only taking over a million of the various instruments and things that were supposed to have radium in them, but it turned out only 2% of them had radium in them, destroyed a million of these things, leveled the building to the ground to bare dirt because the building was, quote, contaminated, even though they hired two separate independent outfits to come in. They couldn't measure any contamination. But the idea is if your instruments aren't, you can't measure infinitesimal amounts, and yet infinitesimal amounts are supposed to be harmful, according to LNT. So they went right to the ground with this guy and destroyed his building and everything else, and then turned around, not only took all of his stuff away, all of his airplanes and everything else, but they got him locked up down at the hangar at the end of the field, and they have charged this guy a bill of $7 million, which is what it cost him to do all this, quote, decontamination. And in some on some basis, they've done it where they are doing it to this guy as an individual, even though it was a corporation that owned the things that he's supposed to be protected by the corporation. But they've nailed him personally, and they since he can't declare bankruptcy under that kind of a suit, they're already assessing his home and property for seizure and sale. And that's how religiously they go after this to protect the public from radiation. And that's in a field nothing to do with nuclear power. Another one is the oil business. And you say, gee, why should we worry about those guys? Well, we're all in this together. And Exxon was sued for $1.06 billion because one of their drilling crew discovered that the sludge that they build, that they bring up from the deep in the earth, contains some radium, some natural radium. And therefore, these guys have been exposed to radiation without their informed and formal consent. And they sued for $1.06 billion and won it. It was later in an appeal court knocked down to 200 and some million, 212 million. But this is the kind of stuff that's going on. This is God's good green earth that these guys are fooling with. They're not making any radioactivity, and yet it's there. So you got to realize that we're talking about a whole concept that anything to do with radiation is somehow more dangerous, more evil, more mysterious than anything else, you know, that other poisons and problems and all that stuff are not in the same class with this terrible concept of radiation.
Just wanted to make a point here in case any of the listeners are not savvy into radiation. When we're talking about LNT, we're not talking about like 600 rem or 1,000 rem doses, which certainly are certainly deadly. We're talking here like in the millirems, or maybe even a few rem, such as I think Kerala, India, they get like 3 rem a year or something like that naturally, and they haven't found any evidence of health effects. That just want to make that note for any layman listeners that might be hearing the podcast.
Yeah, the area of interest, the range of radiation of interest is below natural background. You know, if you really should take this into account, the International Commission on Radiological Protection, ICRP, says that the dose should be, the philosophy should be, at the end of the day, and I'm quoting this now, you should ask yourself, is there any way I could have gotten that dose lower? No other substance or hazard do I know that they do that. And yet, sure you can. I mean, if you're running a nuclear power plant, where do you get the radiation? You get the radiation by going in and inspecting and doing things in where the reactor is, the radiation zone. And if you don't get in there and do the necessary inspections and tune-ups and tests and preventive maintenance, you'll get less radiation.
It's my position that the Davis-Bessey reactor head corrosion problem was caused by a failure to inspect properly.
Exactly. I mean, if you don't go in and see whether boric acid is eating its way through the reactor head or not, you can get a lower radiation. And not only that, but the NRC will give, it's set up that they actually give monetary rewards for people that drop their, manage to reduce their collective dose.
And yet every... might be an interesting place to note that that the actual federal limit for a member of the public is exceeded by the people that, that make the laws in the Capitol building in the, in Washington D.C. because of the amount of radiation that comes off of the granite structure of the building. They actually get more dose than they allow a member of the public to get from a nuclear power plant.
Yeah, that's right. If that was a nuclear power plant, they'd have to demolish it. What I'm worried about is that those kind of numbers are in when people are talking about dirty bombs and nuclear attacks and all that kind of stuff. And if it's above a certain number, why, obviously it's a great public hazard and you should tear the building to the ground. And on that basis, you'd have to tear the Capitol down and Grand Central Station and the base of the Statue of Liberty and a whole bunch of things like that that are built, made of this high uranium granite from New Hampshire.
Right, emitting more radiation than the nuclear power plant is.
That's right.
So, Ted, I know that you've been involved in many discussions with the radiation protection community. What do they say when you are saying, hey, these rules are excessive, they don't protect people from anything that's a hazard, that the studies show that dose rates way below a certain level or below a certain level are not hazardous? What do they say? Why are they resistant to changing the rules and regulations?
They say, don't kill the goose that lays the golden egg.
What do you mean? How is excessive regulation a goose that lays golden eggs?
Well, I mean, there are a lot of guys making a living, but the first guy that sprung that tripped the alarms on the Limerick station was a guy that did that right after they had installed these alarms at the gates where workers come in. They hadn't even gotten any radioactive material into the plant yet. The plant wasn't finished yet, and this guy tripped the alarm. And it turns out he had some radon composition products on his clothes, and they ended up buying up buildings and tearing them down and stuff in that area. And the guy has a unique name. I can't think of it right this second, but I looked up his name on Google the other day just for the fun of it. And sure enough, he's running a radiation remediation company. You know, he's making money off of it like everybody else is. You know, it was supposed to be, you know, so tragic that this poor guy got irradiated. He's doing just fine. And meanwhile, as I say, they practically leveled a town there to get rid of this evil stuff. You can't buy a home in many areas, including this one, until you've had it checked that the radon is below the level that you want. And to do that, you have to put in a lot of unsightly equipment. You have to put a pump under the thing and a vent valve through the roof and all this kind of business to reduce the stuff. And when they get into that kind of thing, you run into things like during the Chernobyl accident, which was a big meltdown in Europe in 1986, and they told people that the radioactive cloud from Chernobyl was headed over Sweden. And they told people to go in and shut the doors and shut the windows tight and wait till this radioactive cloud pass. And Gunnar Waldersen, the Swedish guy that was head of the Swedish radiobiology thing, the head of the UNSCEAR delegation, Sweden and so forth, said that about 1.5 minutes or something like that inside of a Swedish house, because they have such high radon, was worth a week's worth of fallout. You know, I mean, both of these were natural phenomena. If you hadn't had this thing, nobody would have ever known that they had been damaged. And we're dealing with numbers that have a signal to noise ratio of fractions. You know, you're trying to control a signal in a background noise that is just in some cases one or two orders of magnitude lower. And you know, that just is not a technologically sensible thing to try to do.
Yes, when you have levels that are down in the background, or the natural variation background, it's very hard to determine that they're causing any damage at all, particularly when there's no evidence of health effects at those levels. And it's hard to find them and very expensive to clean up to them.
Well, you talk about less than background. There's some wonderful stuff in the hearings on radon limits where the congressmen were saying, you know, by golly, what do you mean you're just going to get it down to background? You know, why don't you get it down to zero? You know, why should we accept that?
Well, it's interesting, even mercury, which now, of course, is being used in the compact fluorescence, it's very interesting when you hear the empty nukes, they will, and someone brings up the mercury, they will say, oh, it's very, very low and not a big thing to worry about. And,
yeah.
And they can immediately turn around and, you know, somehow, you know, radiation is it's death beyond human experience or something like that.
I sometimes
wonder if we haven't done it ourselves. I know one of the terms, there's a very high level of radiation that, where it supposedly, like, directly stops the DNA or something, and the term was molecular death. And I was thinking, we've had like anti-marketers or something in our group that, you know, will not only, you know, raise your electric rates, not only kill your children, but will even kill your molecules. I mean, you know, just we seem to do these things to ourselves.
Well, one technical thing that's important, you talk about radiation, and these books will describe what happens when a gamma ray races through your body and hits a cell and destroys or damages the DNA. And you think, oh my God, I sure want that happening to me. But the fact of the matter is that every cell in your body gets damaged some thousands of times every day by your normal metabolism. Just eating and breathing destroys thousands of cells or damages each cell in the body thousands times during a single day. And the only reason we survive, and the thing that determines whether we survive, is whether the repair processes work. Because normally these things are repaired each time. So it's akin, in my way of thinking, to these guys who are phobically worried about germs. You remember Tesla, Nikola Tesla was one of these guys that used to carry napkins to wipe off doorknobs, that he wore gloves, that he wouldn't shake hands with people because the next germ you pick up might be the one that kills you. But when your mother sends you out in the cold, she doesn't say, wipe off doorknobs. You know, she says to the little kids, keep your scarf warm and your feet dry, and keep your body healthy so that the normal defenses will take care of these extra germs, because the body's full of germs all the time, just like it's full of radiation all the time.
Unfortunately, your mother and my mother, who sent us out into the cold and expected us to have our natural body defenses, are not the way that mothers are. Many mothers are raising their children now. They do send them out with antibacterial wipes and tell them to wash their hands with antibacterial soap every 10 minutes and have a real fear of germs that natural defenses protect us against. So maybe that's also a marketing tool by the people that sell the antibacterial soap.
Yeah. There was a really good article in an environmental green magazine that I read a long time ago about a little kid who his mother was saying it's time to go to bed, and he says, I don't like my bed. I don't want to go up to the bed. And turns out that the reason he didn't like the bed was because they had to murder a lot of trees to make his bed. And she was saying that it's pretty sad when we get our kids in a frame of mind that if we go to make a bed out of nice natural wood, you know, you'd think that would be a good, healthy, green activity. But no, if you have to murder trees, then the poor kid gets paranoid about it.
Something else that concerns me with the excessive fear of radiation is that there are people today who are avoiding very important medical procedures, diagnoses, and even treatments because of they've been told that they should be afraid of the effects of the radiation, more afraid of the effects of radiation than about the potential illness.
Yeah, Bobby Scott just put an article, as a matter of fact, I guess it's coming out in the next few days, entitled CT scans may actually decrease your chance of cancer rather than increase, you know, because of the hormetic effect. Very, very interesting. But in any event, you're going to want to find that you're avoiding looking for important defects in your body on the basis of the very looking that hurts you.
Another area is in the dirty bomb scenario, where I'm far more worried about the effects of explosives than about any radiation enhancements, because I know that the spreading those that radioactive material around would cause very low doses. And people tell me, well, the reason we're worried about dirty bombs is because people be so afraid of them. And I ask them, if they're so afraid, why are they so afraid? What are we as nuclear professionals going to do to try to reduce the fear that immobilizes, that allows terrorism to work? Because if you're not afraid, you can't be terrorized.
I was with a group of high school students about nuclear power a few weeks ago, and one of the people said, well, when Three Mile Island occurred, the psychological impact was, even if it didn't release any significant amount of radiation, the psychological impact was tremendous, and it caused a lot of stress with people and could have caused a lot of problems because of that stress. And I turned and told the person, well, you know, back in October 30th of 1938, it was announced on the radio that the Martians were invading. And that was also causing a lot of psychological stress. But as it turned out, there were no Martians invading. And the problem is with the nuclear industry and the nuclear technology fields not educating the public well enough on the real facts about radiation.
And what's interesting is the tide. I see the tide turning, at least within the profession. If you go look right now at both the ICRP, and I'm not sure if UNSCEAR still has this, but ICRP and the Health Physicists Society, all of their position papers, and say, for example, like if you have a what they call a population dose, one of the things, and I'm sure Ted can explain a lot better than I can, but this oftentimes they'll do an examination, let's say a hypothetical radiation accident, and what they'll do is they'll say that 1 billion people get a few millirem, and then you add it all up into a whole bunch of person rem, and then you get all these, using LNT, you get all these people that are dead. And what these organizations already are saying now is that unless the radiation is 10 rem or greater, that calculation is bogus. And I would think that that's certainly something that the folks could use even now in part of the fight against.
Yeah, that's critical. And the thing that's ironic about it is not only do these reports, that these advisory reports, as they call them, which are really policy-setting reports, because the commissions are obligated by law to pay attention to these guys, but not only are those reports omitting the data that shows that the effect is not only harmful, but not only harmless, but maybe beneficial. Not only are they omitting such reports, keeping them out of the report, they still turn around and say right in the report. I mean, Beer 7, for instance, the latest report on this whole subject, right on page 6, it's got a statement that says it is important to remember that most populations exposed to low-dose radiation are not harmed thereby, and in fact, most such populations are benefited. That's the statement, and I say, why didn't they stop the thing right there? That's the question they were asked to answer, and they tell you that in case that most of people are not hurt, and not only that, but they're most of them benefited, and then they come around with a recommendation that's just the opposite. They do the same thing with the collective dose. They say it's just not scientifically legit to use collective dose to predict deaths and cancers, and they all say that unambiguously right in their report. And then they all set of procedures which require you to do that and pay you money to do it.
It's almost understandable that back in the 1930s, back before we started working with radiation so widespread commercially, that people should have been afraid of radiation and what the long-term effects were going to be. But the fact of the matter is we've been working with radiation now for well over 50 years, and we have a huge population out there that's experienced literally millions of man-hours of it, and we know now, after all of these years, that it's not increasing the cancer rates among those workers. As a matter of fact, there was a Johns Hopkins University study that studied over 30,000 nuclear naval shipyard workers exposed to high radiation. And they were expecting to see higher rates of cancer in those individuals. And as it turns out, they saw lower rates. So they didn't publish the study because it didn't give them what they were looking for. But it's very interesting that that we've done a couple of studies now, and even a couple of studies that occurred as a result of materials being used in apartment buildings like the one over in Taiwan, that actually show that low levels of radiation, even moderate levels of radiation, are producing the exact opposite effect of what we would expect. It's actually lowering the chances of cancer and making that effect of radiation hormesis valid.
So what do we do as nuclear professionals? How do we share this knowledge, and how do we get the regulations to be changed and the protection standards to reflect reality?
Well, it's interesting that right now, within the next few weeks, there are five different policy-making organizations that are having multi-day sessions on the whole subject of health effects of low-dose radiation. The first one is the one I'm going to testify at on the 8th of April, which is the Advisory Committee on Nuclear Waste and Radiation to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. And that's a three-day meeting, and Commissioner Pete Lyons is going to kick it off. And I'm putting that whole package I showed you right into the record at that meeting. And then the next week, the National Commission on Radiological Protection is having a two-day meeting, which they're going through the same thing. The week or two after that, there is a meeting in Miami with the World Nuclear Agency. And at the end of the month, at the end of April, there is the what used to be called the International Hormesis Society, but apparently people think that's a dirty word, so they now changed it to the Dose Response Society. But they're taking the same subject. And then there's going to be a meeting at toward the end of the year on the same subject by the World Association of Nuclear Operators, and that'll be in Lisbon. So everybody is talking about this thing at this point. Everybody knows what the answer is. And the only question at this point on the minds of those people involved is whether they can hold off, keep getting their grants until they're going to retire, or whether it's going to fall before them. And what I'm trying to do is to, if we could create the stampede where people realize that, hey, this thing is beginning to crumble, and I've got to decide whether I want to be one of the guys with a flashlight showing light on the scene, or whether I'm going to be one of the cockroaches running for cover.
And, of course, we do have an example, maybe a less dramatic example of a shift in these kind of things. When I used to do reactor vessel integrity work, one of the big things, and it's still a big assumption, the so-called quarter thickness, the quarter T assumption. It's assumed that every vessel, every reactor vessel in its belt line has a flaw or a crack that's a quarter thickness of the vessel, which was an assumption they made back in the 1960s because, you know, with techniques, and they weren't sure about radiation behavior in the steels. And while they still haven't gone after that assumption, they've put a lot more realism. Reactor vessels now are being, their lives are being extended because the actual science is being finally incorporated into the regulations. Now, it's taken about 25 years of hard work by a lot of folks, but it's very few people, I think, in the industry right now think of reactors as only being able to operate to 40 years. In fact, we're already talking 80 or 100 years on reactor vessels without even treatments like annealing or things like that. So there are examples where sanity has started to prevail.
I think it's important to remember that when we talk about money being wasted, you think of money going down a rat hole and never being seen again. But money doesn't go down a rat hole. Money goes into some rat's pocket. Every dollar that we think of as being wasted is somebody's treasured income. And so you say, why does this continue? And that's why it continues. And it applies to the scientists on advisory committees and the guys that run bulldozers to do decontamination work and, a whole lot of things. The amount of stuff that goes into putting things in the nuclear power plants that don't need to be there, it all is money in somebody's pocket.
One man's cost is another man's revenue.
Right.
Same thing has happened with the asbestos abatement that's been going on. They've actually taken buildings that where the asbestos levels are not even detectable and gone in and performed an asbestos abatement, actually disturbing the asbestos, causing it to be released into the environment when they should have just left it alone.
A quick question for Ted, because I haven't been able to hear too much about it. I know in Europe they're doing something called the RISC-RAD project, where they're trying to actually take a closer look at ionizing radiation and DNA and DNA repair mechanisms among individuals. They're supposed to be coming out with a bunch of reports later this year. I was wondering if you'd heard anything about that, Ted.
Well, I don't know too much about it. There are a lot of ways that people are flailing about trying to figure out how to keep getting income from this thing. The work, for example, where you are measuring beams, single gamma or single alpha hitting an isolated tissue, in other words, it's one ray on one cell, they're finding to their amazement that when you hit a cell with a ray, you wreck it, and that's not informative. That's what it's proportional, twice as much radiation and twice as much damage to cells. But as we've said, that's not what determines how an organism responds. And over 90% of the report content in these big, thick reports on that subject and the kind of research you're talking about is really irrelevant because it's being done with isolated tissue or it's being done with high radiation levels and then extrapolated down, which of course is just begging the question that they're set up to answer.
Yeah, so, I'll have to look at it again because as I recall, they were actually trying to hone in more with lower doses of radiation. That they were trying to, because the big sponsors of this were the French. So
wanted to know the answer. There are several hundred reports available right now in the literature, legitimate scientific reports that do have the low dose information. One of the pet arguments is that if you wanted to go down and gather epidemiological data at lower levels, because the damage is less and less as you go down, it would take millions and millions of subjects in the population to give a statistically significant answer, and therefore we will never know. Well, that's true only if the LNT is true. Obviously, if it isn't, that's a different story, and it isn't, and it is a different story. So what the little syllogism is they've set up is if the LNT is true, then you can't prove that the LNT is true, and so we should assume the LNT is true.
Sounds like the string theory of the complaints about string theory by the physicists. Sounds like we have a nuclear, the string theory equivalent in health physics.
Hey, Ted, help me remember. I'm not a scientist, but I've taken science in college and high school and learned the scientific method. And if I remember correctly, when one has a hypothesis that keeps being disproved by evidence, isn't one supposed to throw away the hypothesis and no longer use it?
Well, you're supposed to at least stop in your tracks and say, hey, obviously we can't go on with this theory until we either, replicate this data or disprove it. But it's amazing. Right after Three Mile Island, EPRI, the Electric Power Research Institute, took on the job of saying, let's put some realistic numbers into these things. They had put unrealistic numbers in and put out reports that said that if a nuclear power plant should ever melt down, the hundreds of thousands of deaths as a result. They said, let's put some realistic numbers in here because we do know what the failure points are of metal, things like that. So when they did that, this was Chauncey Starr and Milt Levinson and Frank Ron and those guys. I'm talking 1980, 1981 now, right after Three Mile Island. They put out a report called Realistic Assessment of the Consequences of a Major Nuclear Casualty. And sure enough, they came up with a thing that says few, if any, deaths would be expected. Few, if any. Okay, and this is assuming, A, that the core melts down, and B, that the containment is compromised. And so you don't have to get into probabilities. And this has been one of the biggest errors I think we make in the nuclear business, is we try to tell the public that, if it ever goes the end of the trail, it's really going to be disastrous, but take it from us, we're not going to get there. You know, the major accident has a probability of 10 to the minus 6, and they used to be 10 to the minus 4, and doesn't that make you feel a lot safer? And no, it doesn't. You know, it doesn't make anybody feel much safer.
And just as a reminder, and I know I've told Rod about this gentleman before, but Herb Inhaber, I know in one of his articles, he said that just taking, even if you kept LNT, but you have the thing where you do not calculate population dose below 10 rem, the limits on accidents drops very, very low.
Yeah.
Just that alone, just the thing that everyone that's now in the position papers of the organization.
That paper
now
came out, and they gave it a lot of publicity at the time. Milt Levinson said he personally visited some 10 different countries and gave this paper and so forth, and nobody repudiated it. It's sitting there. And yet we go on talking about evacuating thousands of people, and the NRC is quoted with individuals quoted by name as saying that you can kill people 500 miles from the accident. And they quote an NRC guy by name as saying that we'll have to decide how many millions to evacuate based on balancing the cost of the evacuation against an acceptable death rate. You know, I showed that to Pete Lyons Friday, you know.
And I hope I'm not trying to gloss over, but actually, if I remember correctly, because Milt Levinson gave that paper at my school when I was, I think it was freshman or sophomore. If I remember right, though, that effort has led to the alternate source term work, the alternate source term rule, the NRC, which, while it hasn't quite brought full reality to how we calculate the source term coming out of nuclear accidents, at least it's done a few things, like it's allowed us to consider things like gravity.
I'll tell you the thing that I have been surprised to learn is that when people want to forget something, when they don't want to hear something, they really have an amazing ability to forget it. And I show people some of these things that have been written and never refuted, and gee, I didn't know that, you know, the guy says. I mean, that sentence that I just quoted from the Beer 7 report that says that most populations are not harmed. All populations aren't harmed, and most are benefited. And he said, gee, I didn't know that was in there. I said, it's the most important sentence in the report, you know. It's right up front, and it's there, and people forget it. And that's why this testimony that I'm trying to give is I'm pulling a lot of that stuff together, which, if you believed what everybody in scientific theory says, that the data has got to take precedence over the theory, and yet these things hit the water and there's no ripples. You know, I talk to people at NEI and say, look, you know, when somebody comes in, there was that terrible report that was written by the guys at the Wilson School, that a fuel pool accident could kill 518,000 people. This is not even a reactor. This is just a fuel pool. And so the press took it to the NEI and said, what about this? And NEI says, well, that's a very improbable scenario. You know, we don't intend to kill 500,000 people very often.
That's not very reassuring, is it? In fact, it's a terrible way to respond to that kind of question.
It sure isn't, and the point is that there are things that are impossible.
And why is it so hard to get people in the scientific community to say that. Things simply cannot happen that way.
Yeah, I mean, because, as I say, you take that report that they wrote in 1980, and after the whole business of 9/11, I got 19 members of the National Academy of Engineering, including very senior guys in the nuclear field, you know, the former Undersecretary of Energy and the head of Argonne Lab and people like that. And we got a peer-reviewed article in Science, which is about as mainstream as you can get. And I don't even know who the peer reviewers were, you know. And yet it's there, and it says that the maximum realistic accident that you can get, assuming that the core melts and assuming that the containment is compromised and the expected result is few, if any, fatalities. And, you know, and people just pretend that never got written.
But it sure is a clear statement that says, hey, this is not something we have to really worry about.
That's why we wrote it. Yeah, that's exactly right. But the point is that I go around to guys who are making these statements about how dangerous it is, you know, and I say, you know, what kind of a reactor are you quoting? And it turns out that they're really kind of going back to the Rasmussen report, you know, where everybody gets killed. Why don't you go back to this report, you know? This is, and it's never been repudiated, and it just says what we already said 30 years before, you know, and nobody's found any fault with it. We've got scores and scores of references backing up every sentence of it.
It would put a lot of HP techs and radiation protection technologists out of a job.
Yeah. Well, the point is, you know, when the automobile came along, it put a lot of manufacturers of buggy whips out of jobs, too, you know. But
there were no billion-dollar manufacturers of buggy whips.
Well, I told the guys when I talked at the WM meetings, the waste management meeting that they used to put on all the time in Tucson, and I said, look, there's that great big exhibit downstairs of guys making a whole lot of stuff, a lot of which wouldn't be needed if these plants were built right. But I said, you guys were clever enough to figure out the market when this new thing came in, and you're clever enough to figure out how to take the next step. You know, you shouldn't tie your future to something that's not needed and keep trying to...
My guess is there will still be a need for a fair amount of HP techs, you know, for operating
But you want to change the HP guy... From an overhead guy who just drags the profits down to a guy who is helping, you know, to make the plant more efficient, more profitable.
Yes.
You know, I mean, have him a positive member of the team rather than just a cop.
Oh, and one other thing I found when you were talking about these models and how they hurt nuclear, it's interesting. Many of the same models are hitting LNG also, liquefied natural gas. I remember a talk by a guy. He was talking about how, you know, again, their accident scenario is that the tanker cracks open, the thing gasifies, it goes over town, exactly these things, and then it explodes. I said, you know, that's stupid.
Those
you know,
are no but, dream.
And it's, yeah, but I'm just saying, it's the same, it's interesting, they're suffering the same problem that we are, everybody coming and saying, oh, these guys are, you know.
No, sure, I mean, now that people have figured out that this is a good way to make a lot of money, the one that got me, John Taylor pointed this out to me years ago, that they're talking about putting an LNG depot on the river just upstream of Calvert Cliffs. And they did their safety report, and this accident that you talk about happens. And they wipe out everything up and down the river for miles and miles, you know. And so they say with a perfectly straight face that, gee, you really ought to shut the Calvert Cliffs plant down every time they come in. Because if this ever happens, you wouldn't want to have radioactivity in the water as well. You know, here they're going to devastate the whole community, and they wouldn't want it radioactive. You know, so we ought to shut the Calvert Cliffs down while they blow up the plant.
I was just thinking, though, maybe this is a, you know, that there may be more allies than we think for getting some more reality into these models. You know, that if you know, the LNG guys are going to be hurt and other folks are going to be hurt. And I don't mean something like with nicotine where you know, like tobacco companies covering things up. But I mean things where we have the science to back it up. You know, we might want to think a little outside the box and get some more stuff. But
I think a big part of the problem is. I talk to some people in the nuclear business, and they'll tell me, you know, in vehement tones, that if you got everything you wanted out of this in terms of the radiation definition, I wouldn't do anything different. And I said, I know you wouldn't, Ralph, but, you know, we'll find guys who will. You know?
Yeah. Gentlemen, I do have to sign off, but I just want to say it was a great pleasure to get to talk to you guys, and hope the rest of the podcast goes great.
Robert, thanks for hanging with us as long as you did.
No problem. Talk to you soon.
Hey, Robert.
Of course, it's not just the people who make money directly off of radiation protection standards who have an interest. There are other people who have direct interest in increasing the cost of building and operating nuclear plants.
Sure. If you're a competitor of nuclear, right?
Or if you're anti-nuclear.
But anti-nuclear doesn't mean anti-energy.
Yeah, if you're in the oil or coal business, like a lot of the members of NEI, for instance.
Or if you happen to sell massive wind turbines, like a member of NEI, whose shall remain nameless, but whose initials are GE, which has a plan to increase its annual sales of wind turbines from $3 billion a year now to $10 billion a year by 2010.
Well, the guys that are making windmills are interested in really making a lot of them and selling them a lot of them. The guys that are making nuclear power plants are getting up every day and telling people how uncertain the whole thing is, the nuclear power, and how you can't expect investors to put any money in it because it's all so shaky and the public is against it. And I know I was going to do this or that, but I've not committed to make any nuclear power plants. You got to get that straight.
I think that's because they have a plan to seek more of the public purse before they make their investments.
Yeah, you know, and they could make so much more money if they just put their heads down and said, we're going to have to do like we did in the war with ships and planes and tanks. We're going to have to go at the whole thing. If you think that the time that we had approval to go start develop a nuclear power plant for the Nautilus to the time we went to sea was a fraction of the time that these guys are now counting on taking to build the 451st plant of the same kind. And there's just no excuse for that. You know, there's no reason to take 10 years to build a nuclear power plant. It's ridiculous. We I think it was 2.5 years, if I remember the numbers right, on shipping port at a time we didn't even know what we were going to make the fuel out of. We thought it was going to be out of metal, and we decided to make it out of oxide. Nobody had ever made oxide fuel before, you know. And now to build one more, it's going to take 10 years, you know, and it's just because there's no will. There is nobody with fire in his belly to go out and build a lot of nuclear power plants. And there are plenty of guys with fire in their belly to go out and build a lot of windmills.
Of course, there are at least a few people who do have fires in their belly about building new nuclear plants, not to mention any names, but George Chapman comes to mind, and so does Rod Adams. But anyway, I'm not sure exactly what I really said during the initial recording of this because Ted's next comment doesn't quite fit in, but here it is anyway.
Oh, yeah. You know, when you slap additional requirements on a plant and you suddenly realize that, gee, you can really call that pollution control, and that just goes into the rate base and you make a profit on it, you know. What's the incentive to not do it? The incentive to not do it is because they're not really interested in, you know, if the price of gas drops suddenly, these guys would all put their money into gas, you know. Nobody's thinking past the next quarter.
And, of course, if there was another dash to gas, the price of gas would not stay low. Anyway, Mike, so tell me, you do a lot of speaking to the public. What kind of reaction do you get when you explain some of these ideas about the real health effects of low doses of radiation?
There's a lot of skepticism. Probably one of the biggest reactions I get when I tell people that the risk of radiation from a nuclear power plant is extremely low is as they smile at me and say, oh, well, that's, you just say that because you work for nuclear power. But when I give them some real world comparisons, like the amount of radioactivity in a banana or the amount of radioactivity that's present in the ground that we're standing over top of in Virginia, or the amount of radiation that you would get in a round-trip flight from L.A. to California is about 50 times as much as you would get from living next door to a nuclear reactor for, it would take 50 years to get the same amount of radiation. So I get a lot of shock and surprise, and as soon as they realize that the facts that I'm presenting are true, a lot of it becomes a surprise as to, well, how come everybody doesn't already know this? And
that's, that's what I get all the time. I get far less resistant from the lay public, you know, neighbors and the guy next to you on the airplane and so forth and so on. You tell them about hormesis and you tell them it's just like vaccination and stuff. And they say, gee, that sounds reasonable, you know. But you talk to the pro-nuclear guys and, oh, the public will never buy that. And they'll just think we're talking in our own self-interest. Of course we're talking in our own self-interest. Who doesn't?
That's exactly right. After all, the American system of jurisprudence and competitive markets and such is that we have an adversarial system. We can't expect somebody else to tell our story for us. We have to tell it for ourselves.
Yeah.
And when it comes to our story, the best reason for being enthusiastic about nuclear power is when you compare it to what the alternatives are.
Yeah, but realize that if you're talking to a guy who owns coal plants, he doesn't want to see you making comparisons between his nuclear plant and his coal plant.
Yep, I've had that conversation in the hallways at NEI meetings several times over the years.
Yeah.
I've often said one of the best ways to turn an anti-nuke into a pro-nuke is to have them go on a tour of a nuclear plant right after they've toured a coal-fired power plant.
Well, that's what Gwyneth Craven said. She said when she went into the first coal plant, and it was like she had always sort of pictured a nuclear plant, you know, all sorts of dark and dreadful things going on, you know. And when she went into the nuclear plant, she said, boy, you know, my idea of hell is one of those coal plants, you know. It's a terrible, terrible place.
Yes, I think her book had a reference to Dante's Inferno in the description.
Oh, yeah.
When I go out and talk to people about radiation, I describe the first day I ever saw a nuclear power station. I drove up the access road to North Anna Power Station to get an interview there. And when I crested the hill and saw the two reactor domes sitting there, I got a little bit of flutter in my heart, maybe a little adrenaline pumping. And as a person who had come from a college education in physics, I was looking at those domes and wondering to myself, I wonder how much radiation I'm getting from those things right now. And it's just incredible the amount of people that are out that are educated that still don't have any idea about the amount of radiation that's not emitted from a nuclear power station.
Well, they don't have because we've never told them. You know, that's what gets me. I heard a story recently on WAMU, the National Public Radio, where they went into a plant. They were talking about nuclear waste. So they go into this plant, and I forgot which one it was, and they said, now, what about nuclear waste? You know, is nuclear waste a problem? And the obvious answer is, no, it's no problem. This stuff is sitting out back. It's been there for 40 years. It'll be there another 40 probably, and we don't care. You know, but the answer was, oh, it's a terrible problem. Why is it a problem? Well, the government hasn't lived up into their responsibility of taking this dreadful stuff out of our backyard where it's such a target for terrorists, you know.
Of course, the used material from our current reactors is really a resource, not a waste problem.
Yeah, that stuff, they're going to be fighting. These guys are so anxious to get rid of it, are going to be bidding against each other to get all that valuable stuff.
I've got to read an excerpt from an article that I found yesterday in the Orlando Sentinel, written by Mike Thomas, a journalist. I would much rather live down the street from a Westinghouse AP1000 than a coal-fired plant. But the most compelling reason for this new facility can be found at the Crystal River nuclear plant. There, at the bottom of a pool about the size of an Olympic swimming pool, you can see all the radioactive fuel rods created by 31 years of operating the plant, and there is room for more. Producing an equal amount of energy from coal would create millions of tons of pollution, ranging from toxic mercury to greenhouse gases, spewed up the smokestack and dispersed around the globe and into the atmosphere. Nuclear power forces you to confront your mess, and even the small amount of it that is there could be cut by more than half if this country decides one day to reprocess and reuse old fuel rods.
Wait, can't beat those words, huh?
Of course, we can say those words all we want, but it sure sounds nice when they come from a journalist, a disinterested journalist.
No, that's great. That's great. You know, our guys, they keep talking about, you know, well, we understand that we've got to solve the nuclear waste problem somehow, and we're going to work on that, you know, on through the century. My attitude on it is, what nuclear waste problem? I don't see that nuclear waste is a problem to anybody. What's the problem? You know, how many people have been hurt by nuclear power waste?
Yep, because there simply is not much waste. It's a small enough volume that we can put it into well-engineered containers and simply use the principles of time, distance, and shielding to protect ourselves from it. That's why nobody has been hurt by this stuff.
Well, and it doesn't hurt you unless you eat it. You know, and you don't really need to eat the glassy stuff, you know.
And like Mike Thomas said, we can recycle this material. I want to leave our children with a legacy of a huge resource and the knowledge of how to use it. I can't understand why people keep talking about this stuff as a terrible thing to leave, a burden to leave behind.
Well, I hear nuclear people, guys who call themselves nuclear advocates, referring to nuclear power as an interim solution until we can really work out, with solar. And it's just crazy.
I like to ask those people if they still have night where they live.
Well, the thing about having night reminds me of a story that NASA was planning a trip to land on the sun, and the guy says, gee, they'll get burned up. And he says, no, no, we're going at night. On that note.
Yeah, it's getting close to time to wrap this up. I do want to highly recommend that if the topics discussed tonight intrigue you, that you should go over and visit the Radiation Science and Health homepage, where those hundreds or thousands of documents that Ted has mentioned are posted and available for reading. One of the things that you'll learn if you go and read those documents carefully is that all of the evidence points to the fact that below a certain level, there is no health or negative health effects from low dose of radiation. In fact, there may be a positive health effect, and that threshold is pretty high, perhaps as high as 10 rem, which surprises a lot of people.
Yeah, a lot of people worry about where are you going to set that threshold, and my answer to that is I almost don't care. I mean, obviously you can get it so low it doesn't do any good, but the critical thing is to knock off this idea that no matter how good a job you do trying to get rid of this radiation, you run around and look for each little radioactive particle that somehow you've got to get to that unreachable zero before you can be safe. That's just foolish, and it doesn't apply to any other substance, and it doesn't apply to radiation either.
And just to give you a feel for how low some of the regulated doses are, the big controversy for the long-term storage of used materials is that we cannot prove that we can prevent the most exposed person from getting 15 millirem per year sometime in the distant future. And that dose is about 1/20th of the average annual exposure for an American.
Oh, yikes. But in addition, only 4 millirem per year via the water path.
That's an incredibly low number. I was always taught that the average annual dose rate to an American is 250 to 300 millirem per year.
The new data, which really freaked everybody out, is somewhere between 500 and 600 with the fact that everybody's getting, you know, a lot of radiation treatment of one kind or another, whether it's dental x-rays or MRIs or whatever.
But even that number is of no real concern because the average annual background varies tremendously over various places in the world, and there's been no real evidence to show that levels much higher are dangerous. After all, we evolved on a planet that used to be a heck of a lot more radioactive than it is today.
Well, and there is also a small amount of data, because it's kind of hard to set up experimentally, but there's a small amount of data on a variety of organisms in which they have been shielded from the radiation, which is hard to do because you've got to get something that's non-radioactive for the shielding. And they have to take, when they're living animals, they have to take the radioactive potassium, which is a natural thing. But they've done that. And when they do, the animals get sick and die. But radiation is essential to life. Interesting, Jaworski made the point that he says that people say radiation is spooky because you can't see it, and you can't feel it, and you can't smell it, you know. And Jaworski says that, well, one, of course, we can detect radioactivity to a lower degree of sensitivity than anything else. You can detect it down to the single atom, you know. Nothing can detect that well. But he says humans don't have organs to detect the stuff because it isn't dangerous in the levels that we're exposed to.
Well, gentlemen, it's been a fascinating evening. I hope that all the listeners have enjoyed this discussion. I hope you're encouraged to go learn more. Remember, radiation science and health, search for the LNT controversy, certainly not a scientific controversy, but definitely a political and regulatory controversy. Also, an economic controversy. Remember, there are competitors to nuclear fission power. And Ted and Michael, thank you for sharing your thoughts, experiences, and knowledge with us. Bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Good night.
There's got to be a better way to light up the world today. Something that we need, something safe and clean. Well, if you're searching, you can find the answer right before your eyes. It's atomic. It's atomic. There's no need to fear. We gotta let the whole world hear. It's atomic. It's atomic. It's atomic. It's atomic. It's atomic.
You're listening to the Podcast Network. Listen, learn, evolve.